Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Sean McDonough. Sean is a leading play-by-play commentator for ESPN, with current assignments including college football, college basketball, and the National Hockey League. Throughout his career, Sean has called games and events in 11 different sports, with premier assignments including Major League Baseball's World Series, the National Hockey League Stanley Cup Finals, the Masters, the Olympics, college football bowl games, and in my humble opinion, most importantly, the Boston Red Sox. Sean was gracious enough to take a break from prepping for both football and hockey this week to share 60 minutes of wall-to-wall actionable insights for us that we can all apply in our business conversations with our employees, our customers, and our personal conversations at home and with our family lives as well. There are going to be so many great points to dive into that Sean will expand on, but a few things to listen for. He's going to talk about how important it is when we're communicating in teams for us all to understand the roles and rules that apply to each of us. He's definitely going to highlight the importance of consistently building trustworthiness over time as we're developing relationships. I was really fascinated to dive into how he learned to stay focused while being forced to multitask in highly dynamic situations. He touches on how important using the right lingo at the right time can be for developing credibility with your audiences. And the theme that kept coming up time and time again, which I thought was extremely powerful, was the importance of enhancing the moment for the people around us, not detracting from the moment that they're experiencing. He had so much to share. It was such a wonderful conversation. I'm really excited to share it with all of you today. Thank you so much for being here. We always appreciate you coming back week after week. Before we dive in, let's thank our sponsors one more time. We have HumanTel. If you have not already, please head over to humantel.com. That's where you can learn more about developing the skills necessary to understand when people's emotions are changing by identifying shifts in their facial expression and nonverbal communication. Once you're at humantel.com, read their research, check out their blogs, then pick out the online training that you believe is right for you. Once you've selected the training, enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the best in-class online training in the subject. It's there at humantel.com. I've done it all myself. I highly recommend it. Go check it out. For the professional interviewers who are listening, check out certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers. How do you become a member? What are the benefits that are available? The online training, the in-person training, the networking, the resources, and so much more. It's all there at certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can also get your questions answered about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Who qualifies and how do people qualify? How do people earn the designation? What's involved for preparing and taking the exam? Once you've earned the designation, what opportunities does that unlock? What could it mean for you and your career moving forward? All those questions and more, again, are answered at certifiedinterviewer.com. And finally, while you're online, please check out inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs that our clients ask us to customize for their leadership teams, their sales teams, and their HR teams to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences that can lead to forging relationships and arriving at agreements that previously may have seemed unexpected to impossible. All of that and more can be found at inquasive.com. Thank you all again for taking the time to join us this week. Get your pad and paper ready. Without further ado, Sean McDonough. Good morning, Sean. It is a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for squeezing us in today. How are you?
I'm doing well, Michael. Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you.
No, my pleasure. Really appreciate it. So I'm going to try not to get distracted by the harbor in the background, but I'm really excited for this conversation. And I probably could bore everybody with Boston talk for the entire conversation, but really what I would love to do is dive into the craft of communication through your lens, calling so many different sports with so many different people for so many years at the highest level. I've been fortunate enough going back to my childhood days, watching you with Bob Montgomery, I think on Channel 56, if I remember correctly.
Channel 38, the old WSBK, TV 38.
That's what it was. And now I get to watch hockey games with my son and listen to you. And it's the reverse roles for the experience I had with my dad. But over all those years and having an appreciation for your craft, I would love to share with our audience some of your techniques, secrets, approaches, whatever it is, to how you build rapport and communicate and share all the things that you do. So I'd like to start, if I may, with a broad question, and please take it anywhere you like, and we'll kind of run with it from there. But over the years, how did you develop the skill of clearly and concisely communicating everything you see that's unfolding in front of you in real time?
It's a great question because most of the time, we have boundaries that are already established for us. I mean, if I'm calling a football game, my job is basically to call the action as the play-by-play person while it's happening. And then the time in between the plays is really the domain of the analyst. And then when they snap the ball the next time, it's really my time again. That's a little bit of a broad generalization because sometimes, in between plays, I might tell a story or relay an anecdote, whatever the case might be, ask the analyst a question if nothing happens. So sometimes they're just sort of the defined boundaries. A lot of other times in sports, it's harder because, like hockey, the play goes up and down and up and down and there's no natural time. Okay, when there's a stoppage in play, most of the time the analyst comes in. One of the problems we have in our business now is when there's a stoppage, a lot of time they need to get the sales item in or the promo in, or you're throwing it back to the studio. So, sometimes there isn't. So, and in my situation in the hockey, I'm not even in the same booth with Ray Ferraro. I'm upstairs in the broadcast booth. He's between the benches in most of these, and really in all of these arenas that we go to. So even that communication can be a little more difficult because he's not, most of the time when you're right next to somebody, you can look at them and kind of say, I have more to say or whatever. They tell you, hey, bring me in. I'd like to add to what you just said. So in hockey, what I generally do is just pause from if a player's behind his own net and it's clear he's not going to, something good or bad isn't going to happen in that moment. They're changing lines, whatever. I'll pause a second or two. If Ray comes in, great. If he doesn't, then I'll just pick it back up. But, I've worked with about 150 different analysts in these different sports. So, and everybody has their own rhythm and timing. So it's a good question because, it takes a little time with each of them to figure out, how they like to interact, when they like to come in and when they're not going to come in.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. And I'd like to just go there first. I think there's probably 100 follow-up questions layered in there. But starting with the analysts, 150 or so, what are your favorite approaches to building rapport with all of these different analysts in different sports? So
I think the most important part, Michael, is the time away. That when you're in a college football town or you're in a city where you're going to do a hockey game, have dinner with the group the night before. And not just the analyst, but the sideline reporter, the producer, the director, because it's a total team effort and it's constant communication with them. The producer is really the head coach of our operation. He or she is the decision maker about what we do, when we do it, when do we throw these elements in, when do we just keep going. So the camaraderie across the whole group is important. I'm also communicating with them during the game on our headsets. We have a button, which is a talkback button, where I can hit it and it mutes my microphone over the air and it turns it into an intercom into the truck. So I can say, hey, after this next play, if nothing happens, I'd like to tell the story about Coach Jones. And, and they say, okay, good. And then they know to put the camera on Coach Jones rather than I just starting a story about somebody and they don't know what I'm talking about. And now they're scrambling. Who is he talking about? Which coach is that? Which guy is he on the sideline? So, there's a lot of communication that goes into some of these things that people who watch the game are never aware of. But, I think the relationship building away from off the air is super important. And I try to take as much advantage of the time that I can, in social situations, even things like playing golf. The first year I worked with Ray Ferraro during the playoffs, we had some off days and, we went and played golf. That's 4 hours of, in the cart or walking and talking and about family and life experiences and that sort of thing. So I think a strong rapport and relationship off the air really comes through on the air. And I think when you don't have it, that shows up too. There can be some awkward moments.
Yeah, I mean, even sometimes just the pauses or the dead air or the missed expectations. And I'm sure at this point, recovering quickly.
I worked with an analyst a couple of times who I would ask questions on the air, and sometimes he didn't answer them because he just didn't want to. So, and that is very awkward TV. You know, that should never happen. So, yeah, it's, and I've been very blessed, you know, with 150 or so of people that I mentioned, it'd be less than one hand of the people who I really didn't enjoy working with. The vast majority of them are at least good. Most of them great. And many, many, many of them have become, you know, some of my dearest friends.
That's fantastic. You talked earlier about the headsets and the buttons and all the conversations that are happening that we don't get to hear. For most of us, multitasking can be the death of a conversation. For you, multitasking is necessary. Whether he's next to you across the ice, making some sort of connection with your analyst, you're calling what you're seeing in front of you, you're listening to the team talking in your ear, all of these things going on. How did you develop the brain capacity and the ability to concentrate on so many moving variables at the same time?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, a lot of times over the years, friends of mine will say, "Whoa, what a cushy job you have. You work 3 hours, you know, in 1 or 2 days a week." And, you know, first of all, the preparation time is, you know, multiple times the actual time we're on the air. But then the other part of it is, and I've said to them, okay, come to the booth, you know, come to a Red Sox game when I was first starting, or come to an ESPN or ABC event that I'm doing now, and watch everything that's going on and see if you think that's easy. You know, we already talked about, you know, there's constant decision making for the people in the truck and for us about what do you say, when do you say it, which graphics do you put up, is this the right time for the replay or the roll in of a flashback or a personal story, is this the time for an interview with the coach? And then, you know, while I'm talking, a lot of times there's people talking in our ear. You know, the good producers and directors minimize that, but sometimes they have to. The good ones try to talk when you're not talking because it is distracting when you're trying to say something. I always describe it like being on a phone conversation and talking to the person on the phone. And at the same time, you're trying to understand what somebody in the room is saying to you while processing and continuing to communicate without pausing to the person on the phone. So, there's a lot going on. We have stats people handing us information. We have stage managers handing us cards to read at the end of the play. You know, if the analyst is gesturing sometimes about something he or she wants to say. So there's an awful lot of stuff going on in the booth, just a lot of communication beyond just me speaking on the air and people listening.
One of the things, just knowing a sliver of that fascinates me the most about the people in your role is how that comes off seamlessly. If I'm trying to listen to one conversation, have another, and I'm at my son's youth baseball game, and I'm trying to concentrate on his at-bat while my wife is talking to me about dinner and my friend on the other side is asking me about something we're doing this weekend, I'm probably dropping the ball on all three of those tasks that I'm trying to create. So just developing the mental faculties to be able to balance that is impressive from the outside.
Well, a lot of it is just right experience. Yeah. The more you do it, and then the more you work with the same producers and the same directors. And I've been pretty fortunate over the years that, once you start into these projects, it's a lot of the same people. They know, you know, how you like to be told what they're thinking or doing. You know, a lot of the best things happen during the commercials, right? We really need to take advantage of that 2.5 minutes or whatever it is to say, okay, you know, what are we doing next? What are we missing? Does Molly McGrath have that story that, you know, she wanted to get in? Because now seems like a good time about it before, because it's about Michael and he just did something in the game. So, you know, we try to take advantage of that time. So there's not a lot of jibber jabber back and forth. Because part of the problem too is, you know, a lot of times when they're talking here, if I get on the talk back and I'm talking to them and I don't realize the analyst is saying something to me that he or she expects a response, that can also be TV. You know, like you're looking at them, you realize, oh gosh, they just asked me a question or said something that they were expecting me to respond to, and I missed it because I was on the talk back button talking to the truck. So yeah, there's a lot of moving parts, but I think the most important part is just the experience. You learn how to do it. You know, a lot of times, you know, when you're listening to the truck, it's just picking out the keywords. You know, mm-hmm. you're not necessarily listening intently to every single thing, but you know, you'll hear studio or something, you know, which means after the play, they want you to throw it back to the studio. So, yeah, a lot of it's just experience and working with the same people.
Yeah. And you mentioned the depth of the preparation that goes in. But just in a couple of conversations we've had, you've mentioned the interviews you have with coaching staffs and players and things coming up before games. For me, from looking at it from a different perspective, I feel like success in most conversation scenarios can be really drawn down to variable management. Whoever manages the variables in the conversation the most successfully is likely going to be in place to be more successful during that interaction or get more out of the interaction. How significant of a role does your preparation play in order to allow you to seamlessly move through all the dynamic and sometimes unexpected occurrences of calling a game?
Yeah, it's the most important thing by far. You know, it's what I say whenever I speak to wannabe sports broadcasters. You know, and those conversations with the participants are the most important part of it. You know, I'm getting ready as we speak to do a football game, college football game this weekend. And what we typically do is on Wednesday of the game week, we will do a Zoom call with the head coach, the offensive coordinator, the defensive coordinator of the visiting team. Because a lot of times when they get to the game location on Friday night, they're on a tight schedule. They have meals and meetings and film reviews. And a lot of times their hotel, especially in these smaller college towns, might be a 90-mile drive away. And they're just going to bus in from that hotel the next day. So, you know, a lot of times you just can't be there in person. I'd rather do it in person if we can. I think you get more out of it. But with the, you know, emergence of Zoom, one of the few good things that probably came out of COVID is, you know, the usage of Zoom. Now, it used to be we were just on a conference call. You know, we'd all be on our phone or around a speaker, and you're talking to some coach, and you know he's eating lunch and not really paying attention and probably watching film at the same time that he's talking to. So at least now on Zoom and you can see them, you know if they're engaged or not. But you know, I think I get the most information out of that because the offensive and defense coordinators in particular, you know, if they trust you, and I've been fortunate, I've been around long enough that you build relationships with these people over the years, they'll give you more information. They'll be honest with you. Here's what we're going to try to do. Here's where we think the other team is vulnerable. You know, our middle linebacker stinks, you know, or if he, you know, and then, but or he's hurt. So if he can't play, then we're really in trouble because the backup stinks. Or, you know, and then other times you just get coaches who say, you know, we have to be good on third down. We can't turn it over. We got to stop the run. You know, and you're like, okay, thanks a lot. So, and then the part I enjoy the most is we usually get, and then Friday, by the way, we do that all of that set stuff I just described in person with the home team. We go to their football building, sit in the conference room and have it in person. So I enjoy the time with the players because I think a big part of our job, especially in college sports, like on the college football games, people don't know, a lot of people watch this game don't know anything about these players. You know, if you watch the NFL every week and you're a fan of the New England Patriots, you knew who Tom Brady was or whatever. So, but a part of our job is to humanize the participants. So to get the opportunity to talk to two or three players on each team every week and delve into their backgrounds. And you know, some of these kids come from remarkably difficult backgrounds, and they're willing to share that with you. So, you know, I think it makes people take a rooting interest in them when you can tell their story. So, you know, those meetings are super important. You know, some of our production group colleagues, I think, kind of dread them. Like they're, oh gosh, we got to listen to the coach again say the same thing for the 12th straight week of this football season. But I really look forward to it.
With you mentioned building trust through relationships and over time, and I do often wonder. I would imagine for most coaches, at least initially, and even probably some of the players, like exactly what you just said, we need to dominate the line of scrimmage. We need to limit turnovers. You know, yeah, right. You and every other football team from Pop Warner to the Super Bowl.
Right.
As you build relationships over time and start to earn that trust. So I'm imagining they feel like they can tell you things that won't get to the other team or won't leak out inappropriately on the broadcast and all those things. Are there specific techniques that you use to build trust in those scenarios over multiple interactions to get them to continue to open up to you over time?
Not really. I mean, I try, You know, one of the things that I've learned throughout from other people, you know, if you have time, don't dive right into the, you know, how come your defense gave up 500 yards last week? What are you going to do about that, coach? You know, it's don't put them on their heels. You know, get them talking about something that, you know, is easy. And, you know, it's kind of like playing golf. You like to start on a nice, easy first hole and maybe make a par or even a birdie or something. Get off. Assuming we have time, I try not to dive right into the stuff. Now, sometimes they say you get 15 minutes with coach so-and-so and there's an important topic you need to get to. You can't dilly-dally around too much. Plus, you never know how long their answer is going to be. So, you know, they may fill the whole 15 minutes on two questions and then you're done. So, you know, I think most of that trust just comes over time, right? You've met with them a bunch of times and, you know, you've never violated anybody's confidence before. One of the things I think they understand, the coaches understand, is, you know, and a lot of times the players, they're excited. You know, oh gosh, I'm talking to TV announcers. They're probably going to talk about me on this game. And most of the kids like, you know, if you're the quarterback of the, you know, one of the top teams in the country, and this is the 13th straight week you've met with the TV crew and answered the same question, that might not be so exciting. But most of it, I think, is over time. And the other reality is if we ever violated the confidence in those meetings, you know, if they told us, hey, we're going to run a reverse pass on the first play of the game and blah, 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 and we told somebody, we'd be fired and we should. You know, it's the ultimate violation. And I also think, Michael, the other part is the smart coaches, at least about this part of the process, understand this is their chance to communicate to us what they want to get across, you know, about their program or their players or whatever. So their own careers. So you know, some will come in even with like talking points that it almost doesn't matter. It's like today, the political world we live in now, where it doesn't matter what the question is, the person's going to give whatever answer they want. So, you know, most of the coaches are pretty cooperative. It's a few who just would rather not be there. And, you know, a couple of times over the years, I've even said, hey, coach, if you don't want to do this, we can announce the game without this meeting. You know, this is really your chance to tell us what you want us to know. That's the way I look at it.
And I would imagine that over time, that's actually a rapport building technique in and of itself, like not forcing the coach to go through it. They respect that you see and respect that. And it might not have the immediate impact. Oh, well, now that you said that, here's 20 minutes of unfiltered conversation. But over time, I imagine that helps build a relationship because you're probably going to see most of these coaches and kids more than once over the course of several seasons.
A lot of times. You're a Red Sox fan. When I was relatively new doing the Red Sox games, the Jimmy Williams was our manager, sadly just passed away. He was a nice guy. So usually the manager will meet with the media 2.5-3 hours before the game either in the clubhouse or sometimes in the dugout. So we're in Oakland and doing the game. And I asked, and I can't remember, it was like Real Cormier or somebody, or some left relief pitcher. Mm-hmm. Is he available to pitch tonight? And Jimmy was a little bit of a contrarian, and he would frequently question the question. So he said, why do you always have to ask me that? Like, well, la, 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 la. I said, okay, here's why I'm asking you this. It's to protect me from unfairly criticizing you. Because if it's the seventh inning and there's a left-handed hitter coming up and we think the lefty pitcher should be in the game to pitch to him, but he's not in the game because you have no intention of using him because he's pitched too much lately as it is, then I don't want to criticize you for not putting him in the game if you had no intention of putting him in the game. And he said, oh, okay. I get it. And then he answered the question, right? So sometimes you have to explain to them that you're really asking these things as a way of, you know, I'll ask the coaches, what's the longest field goal you think your guy can make? So we don't say, you know, why aren't they trying this 52-yard field goal when maybe the kid can only make a 48-yard field goal? So, you know, that's a part of it. But, you know, sometimes they don't want to be there. Some of them are just contrarian or even confrontational by nature. And that's when I say, you know what, we don't need to do this, or I can skip the meeting if the rest of the group wants to talk to you. But yeah, I'm too old and cranky now to sit there and just have people lob questions back in your face or shove them back in your face because they just don't want to be there.
Yeah, we all have better use for our time at that point, especially with the schedule that you keep. Yep. You mentioned loving talking to the players, and I'll say kids, like you said, the younger athletes.
Well, they are kids to us, or at least to me. I'm significantly older than you.
I'm trying to catch up. What differences do you see? Let me ask the question this way. How do you have to adjust your approach when you talk to college players versus professional players prior to calling games?
You know, it's interesting too, because I just read an article yesterday and the headline was something like, is it okay to boo college kids now with NIL and that a lot of them get paid? You know, because it used to sort of be, well, boo the pros if they're not playing well or it doesn't seem like they're trying because, you know, they're getting paid a lot, but these college kids out there doing the best they can. So, yeah, it's different, you know, and just because a lot of times their lives are different, right? I mean, these pro players are out of college. A lot of them have families, you know, you're not sitting there spending time about what are you studying? What's your major? You know, what's tell us about, you know, with the NFL players, I did ask about their family sometimes, you know, a lot of times, hopefully you've done the preparation ahead of time. You've read articles about these people, or you've asked the sports information director at the school, hey, if we're going to talk to Michael, what should we talk about him with him about? What's interesting about his background or life or football career or whatever the case may be? But I don't think the actual questions are all that different. You know, if they're different, it's really more a product of, you know, where they are in their lives rather than, you know, oh, this guy's a little younger, so I need to ask a easier question or phrase it differently. You know, even though these guys are 18 to 22, a lot of these college kids are older than that. Now we've got guys in college, but one guy's in his ninth year.
Yeah.
But you know, so some of these guys you're talking to are 24, 25 years old, but you know, most of them have been through enough life experiences where, you know, they're grown men.
It's interesting that you mentioned the article about booing. I've found as I've gotten older, like when I was younger, you know, pick two teams, it doesn't matter. The team I want to win is trying to stop a last minute drive to hold on to the victory. And they trot their field goal kicker out. And as a younger man, I'm like, I really want that kid to miss this field goal. And then after a while, I'm like, I don't know that I want the kid to miss the field goal. Like, I don't feel good rooting against a kid out there in front of 100,000 fans and millions of people watching. Like, I hope the field goal finds a way not to go in. I still want my team to win, but I don't feel good like actively rooting against probably a 19 to 21 year old kid to go out there and shank it. Like, I want my team to win the game, but I don't want this poor kid to suffer because of it.
Yeah. And we experience all that too. You know, it's, and I think especially as you get older, you know, the humanity part of it, you know, is a big part of it. And I think we should respond to that rather than, you know, it's, you know, I did infamous game, if you're a Michigan fan, where Michigan played Michigan State and the Michigan punter dropped the ball. Mm-hmm. And, it wasn't a great snap. And I felt bad for him, you know, but the circumstances of it were, you know, the ball hopped off his hands. It was the last play of the game, went up in the air. Mm-hmm. Michigan State guy grabbed it, ran down the sideline. They won. They were about to lose, unless this miracle happened. And, you know, sometimes just the timing of it, like we didn't even talk really about the punter or the snapper because the ending was so amazing. It was really about the crowd shots and the crowd noise and the reaction of the Michigan State players and the shocked Michigan fans and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. So, you know, sometimes the circumstances dictate what you actually talk about, but yeah, I feel bad when guy throws a terrible interception or, you know, especially a lot of times we just met with these people the day before and most of them kind of like, so, yeah. But you know, I get asked all the time, oh, you were a Bruins fan or a Red Sox fan, or, you know, I grew up here and I tend to be fans of the Boston teams, but you know, as you go along and you make friends, you know, who are coaches of these pro teams or college teams or their GMs or announcers of teams who you like, you know, you kind of like to see them do well. But you really have to take all the fan emotion out of it when you do a game because it's, you know, you owe it to, there are people rooting for both sides and nobody likes to feel like, you know, oh my God, the announcer's cheering for the other team. Yeah, you know, I've had that on Twitter, you know, I don't do Twitter, but sometimes on a flight home on Saturday night, I'll ask my spotter, okay, read me a couple of the meanest ones because I find some amusement out of it, like the mean tweet segments you see on TV. And we're coming back from a game. last year, I guess it was. And he said, he started laughing. I said, what are you laughing about? I said, well, I'm going to read you like four or five in a row. And it was literally one person, why is Sean McDonough cheering for this team? Then the other person was, why is Sean McDonough cheering for that team? They were watching the same game and they each thought I was, and it was about six in a row alternating. I was clearly cheering for team A. I was clearly cheering for team B. I hate team A. I hate team B. It is like, so you can't get up and you can't get caught up in worrying about that. But you do need to give an impartial call.
I think especially on, not that my opinion carries anyway, I think especially on the national broadcasts.
That's yeah, local games, it's fine to be a homer, as we say in our business. You know, I think that part of it, Michael, I have college kids ask me about that from time to time. And I think that broadcaster needs to do it in whatever style comes naturally to him or her. You know, if you want to root for your team and be a homer and that's kind of who you are, you know, there's a big fan part of you, then that's who you should be, right? But when I started out, I certainly wanted the Red Sox to win. But if a guy dropped a fly ball that he should have caught, I wasn't going to say, oh, that was a hard play, you know, just because root for the home team. You know, I think that's an insult to the people watching. So there's a fine line, but I think either one of those styles or somewhere in the middle is fine.
Yeah, on the national broadcast as a fan, I enjoy the impartiality. But listening to Derek Sanderson be an analyst for Bruins games, or Tommy Heinsohn on Celtics games, or even living out in Chicago, listening to Hawk Harrelson call a White Sox game, like, I really appreciated the homerism in that. Like, they're invested in the team that they represent, and I appreciated that.
Yeah, and a lot of fans do. I mean, the people you just mentioned are some of the most, you know, popular broadcasters of their time. And I do think a high percentage of the people watching the local broadcast, like watching Hawk do a White Sox game or Tommy Heinsohn do the Celtics game here, the vast majority of people who are watching that telecast want the Celtics to win or want the White Sox to win. So, you know, they're probably watching and saying, damn right, Tommy, that was a terrible call. And these refs have been, you know, screwing us the whole game. So, you know, I get it. And there are times, you know, when I did a Red Sox game where that part of me would come out. But I think more it was just people could tell, you know, I got a lot more excited when the Red Sox hit a home run or scored a run than I did when the other team did.
Sure.
You know, it was pretty obvious I wanted the Red Sox to win. Why wouldn't I, right? I mean, I work for the station that's broadcasting the games. When they win, more people watch, more revenue for the station. You know, I think any of us who do these games want to do games that people are watching. So, yeah, it's natural to kind of root for the home team on the local broadcast. But you know, on the national games, you got to be straight down the middle. And it's funny because I know Twitter just lights up with almost every game that's on national TV.
Yeah.
The broadcaster's cheering for the other team. And it's funny because I watch a lot of games, as many as anybody probably, and see a lot of my friends and colleagues out there. And I never think, oh, my God, Joe is cheering for team X, or, you know, Mary is cheering for team Y. You know, it's good, but it doesn't happen. It really doesn't. And, you know, a lot of it is just the excitement level of your voice. You know, I did a hockey series a couple of years ago. We did the first two games in one city. The home team won. Now we're game three back in the second place. And the elevator operator is taking me up to the press box and some other people. And he's like, I have a bone to pick with you. I said, what's that?
Sure.
You got way more excited when the other team scored than our team. I said, well, you know, part of that dynamic is when you're in the home team's arena and they score, you're yelling over the crowd. Where when your team is on the road and they score, no one's cheering, or very few people are. So it's just naturally, you're not going to yell at the same. I said, I promise you tonight, when your team scores, I will yell louder than I probably will for the, almost certainly will for the visiting team, because that's kind of the way this works.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same way in every sport. The home team scores a touchdown, you're going to sound more excited because it's just natural. Part of that is, you know, you're lifted up by the crowd.
And across context, so many people fail to consider the context of the situation. Like, what other factors are going on that's impacting what somebody is saying, doing? Like, all of those things matter, and all those things get taken into account. What was being said in his ear? Who was tapping him on the shoulder? What's happening in front? Like, all of these things impact at any given moment. And for people to make such strong judgments based naturally on their biases or their limited knowledge or expectations without having any knowledge of the context. It's, you know, there's 52 cards in the deck. Yeah,
that's very, very true. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that I just don't do social media, because I don't want to be annoyed by that kind of commentary. But the, you know, and the other part of it is, from our standpoint, at least from mine as a play-by-play person, you know, you have to build into the moment, right? If you come out in the first batter of the game, ground ball to short and he throws him out. Well, then, you know, when something actually exciting happens, you know, and I see that in football games, the play-by-play person is basically yelling on a 4-yard gain so that when something really meaningful happens, you know, there's no separation of your excitement level. The big moment sounds like the mediocre moment or the really boring moment. So, you know, to me, there should be kind of a crescendo, and you shouldn't even have to think about it. I have students ask me a lot, you know, well, what's your philosophy of calling a big player? How do you call a big play? And I always say, I don't even think about it, right? It's just, you know, the situation. I mean, you know, when that Michigan, that's an extreme example, but you know, when that Michigan State thing happens, this is crazy, you know, and it's because, so you shouldn't have to sit there and think, oh my God, this is the wildest ending I've ever seen. So I'm going to scream really loud now, because I mean, you don't have time to have that thought process, right? It has to be your instinctive, it's almost an emotional and physical reaction to the thing, just based on the moment. And I think some people in our business don't always have those instincts. You know, they just scream and yell from the beginning and then which doesn't really make any sense. So, yeah, I think the way you communicate what's happening in the game should be reflective of the magnitude of the moment and the, you know, the excitement of the moment in the game.
And I certainly appreciate that from a viewer's standpoint. You might have just answered the question. I'm going to ask it anyway. So if you did already answer it, you can be that college coach that says, dude, I just answered that question. Why did you ask that?
Or you can just edit it out.
No, I'll leave it so people can laugh at me. That's all right. When you're leaving, you talked about leaving room for the moment, which I think is fantastic because people get to experience the ride as they go through the entire game. How much, whether it's through preparation or just through how the game unfolds, how much attention do you put into creating an experience for the audience? So it's not just a, this is what I'm seeing, this is what you need to know, but they're getting as much of like the full emotional experience of everything that's unfolding on the ice or on the field or on the court?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I've always said, you know, we were at a seminar, college football seminar, which we have every year at ESPN before the season starts. So a couple weeks before the season, they bring in all the announcers, the producers, directors, and we have group meetings where they give us a lot of stuff. But then we have some breakout sessions, and for a few hours, it's just the play-by-play guys in the room and play-by-play women. And the producer who was leading it asked a question. Well, it's a basic question, but how do you see your role? Like, what? How would you describe what your job is within the telecast? And, you know, my basic philosophy has always been, we should enhance viewers' enjoyment of the game and don't detract from it. So, you know, friends of mine say, oh, you're funny, you should be more funny on TV. Well, I don't want people to think I'm calling attention to me, and they tune in to watch the game, unless it's my family. You know, they didn't tune in to watch me. So yeah, at the right moment, especially if something funny happens or you think of something clever to say. But, you know, to get up there and be, you know, Sean at the Chuckle Hut is not, but really, it's not our job. So, you know, and there's a lot of ways you can enhance people's enjoyment of the game. There are a few ways you can detract from it. One of them I talked about, by, you know, blatantly cheering for one team, which, as I said, I think almost never happens at this level anyway. But, you know, talking too much, which I've already done in this interview. Yeah, I think it was Pat Summerall said, nobody ever complained that the announcers didn't talk enough. You know, people like the silence every now and then. We don't have to talk between every play. You know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, the bands are playing and there's crowd shots and shots of the coaches and the cheerleaders. We don't have to say something every second of the broadcast. And sometimes you watch sporting events and people are constantly talking to the point where I'm like, come on, shut up for a minute, you know? So I'll say that to Greg McElroy, I used to say to Todd Blackledge, it feels like we're talking a lot. So coming out of this break, you know, if nothing happens on first down, if it's a 1-yard gain off tackle, let's just not say anything. And, you know, and we let, and the producer and director can hear us say this. So, you know, okay, I'm going to cut in band shots or crowd shots or whatever, and just let people experience the moment. So, you know, it's really the, it's a long-winded answer to your question after talking about don't talk too much, but the part of it's the feel of when is the right time to do things. And that's a collaborative effort with the producer and the director and your other announcers. You know, okay, it's 56-3. It's okay to tell a long story about, you know, Michael has a great stamp collection that he got from his grandfather, you know, or, you know, or his house, you know, when he was a kid. You know, we've had all kinds of stories over the years that I've told about, you know, my house got wiped out by a tornado when I was 8 years old. Like, wow. But when it's, you know, 21-21 and one team is on the 3 yard line with a minute to have to go, you're not talking about he's a, you know, 4.0 student in pre-med, you know, so there's kind of the balance of, all right, now's the time for the story. Now we really need to stick with the game. Now we should really get into the strategy of, should they be going for this fourth down? Should they punt? And now you have the added element of that too with analytics. Mm-hmm. Well, the coach isn't a big believer in analytics, but analytics says 4th and 6, he should be going for this, not punting from the 50-yard line. So, you know, there's always a million decisions that you're making, but hopefully it's in the, I always try to talk about what I think the viewer, I would be thinking if I was sitting in my living room watching the game and thinking, why aren't they going for that? Like, he's going to punt? That's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. You know, that's what I want to hear the announcers talking about. So I try to think, what would I be thinking if I was watching the game at home? Why aren't they pinch hitting? Why are they leaving this pitcher in? Whatever the case may be.
Yeah. And you mentioned that the different sports in that explanation, which I felt was perfectly timed for the record. When I asked you to be here, so you could do all the talking, not me, for the record. I think back to like a baseball game.
Well, I think I'm succeeding at that, and I apologize for.
No, none are necessary.
One of the reasons I like podcasts and this sort of thing, because it does give you a chance to, you know, get into more detail about subjects.
Yeah. I think back to baseball games, 9 innings. Ugh. Back in the day, if it was a Sox-Yankees game, that could be 4 hours of your life that you're, and that's what the game, that's not even counting before and after and all that stuff. So there were plenty of times to listen to you and Jerry Remy go through any number of funny stories, personal stories. Felt like a lot more room for humor in a longer baseball game. A hockey game, they drop that puck and they're shot out of a rocket for 3 periods. That's happening so fast, probably less time. Football happens in the middle. And I felt like, particularly listening to you and Chris Spielman, I could have watched you two call Northwestern Iowa on a Saturday afternoon over other games because of the dynamic that the both of you had and the way that you, his intensity and the way that you called the game, I thought was great. But I think that's a wonderful explanation for really understanding the moment. Like, is this a moment that I can add flavor to? Or is this a moment that has enough flavor on its own and just needs to marinate for the audience? And whether you're in sports broadcasting or whether you're in a conference room with your team or whether you're out to dinner with a customer, that same rule applies.
Right. Yeah, 100%. Now, and you did mention a couple of my favorites in Chris and Jerry. And it really hit on the head with Chris. You know, looked like he still could play and wanted to play, you know, he was in the booth, you know, he'd like to be out there hitting somebody. One of the best people I've ever known. You know, when you talk about how the rapport on the air has helped, if you have a personal relationship off the air, you know, Chris and I are still keeping in touch. I haven't worked with Chris in, gosh, probably 7 or 8 years, but you know, we did a game in Michigan last year and he's now with the Detroit Lions in the front office. And I stayed after the game and, you know, went to the game the next day with he and his family and had a great time. So, I don't go into it thinking I'm going to tell a funny joke. Now, sometimes you might have a story about a player, a coach or something that happens to be funny, but most of the funniest things are spontaneous things that happen in the game that you could never anticipate. And they trigger some weird thought in your mind or whatever. And then that was particularly the case with Jerry Remy. One of the things, like I'm a big proponent of the pitch clock. You know, I thought baseball was just getting unwatchable when players, particularly pitchers, could just walk around as long as they want, basically, with no time limit. But as a storyteller, it helped because, you know, there's plenty of time. And a lot of times the stories weren't even about what was happening in the game. Sometimes you got, you know, Jerry and I would start talking about soap operas he watched during the day. And you know, it would prompt a funny moment. You know, one time we had Judge Judy on because she happened to be in a Red Sox game. And it was hilarious, especially what we said after she left. So, you know, but with the pitch clock, which I do think has helped baseball, it really has diminished storytelling. You know, it's now, and I'm still doing some Red Sox games here on radio, and not a lot. I think I did 18 this season. But the, you know, now it's here's the pitch ball one, here's the pitch ball two. You know, be sure to buy a Herb Chambers Toyota. Here's the pitch ball three. Blah blah blah. That's the end of the inning. So a lot of times you start into a story and you don't get it in because now it goes by so fast, which is a trade-off I'll take. But you know, Frank Cherkinian, who was the legendary CBS golf producer director, who really invented a lot of the way golf is covered and even the scoring system based on relative to above par, below par, so people could tell who was winning the tournament. The first year I did the Masters in 1997, he told me, "We're putting you on here in part because you're a really good storyteller and we want you to tell stories, but in golf, we never know when we come to you, how long we're staying. A lot of the shots are on tape, so we have to get off it because the tape's going to run out. So you need to learn to tell a story that ends at the end of every sentence." I'm like, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, like, for example, I spoke to Tiger Woods this morning on the practice screen and he's using a new putter. You could stop there. You have a little more time, and he's using this new putter because, you know, his back's hurting, so he wanted a longer putter, or he wanted a little more loft in the putter." You can, but you need to tell a story like that where you can almost add one sentence at a time. And I thought that was a great skill to learn, and I've tried to adapt that to everything I do now. You know, a lot of times in hockey, you have a story you want to tell, but as you said, there's time for one sentence. One of the things I learned when we came back into the NHL 3 years ago is the game's a lot faster than it was 17 years before when ESPN last had the NHL. So you don't have a lot of time. You know, if you're going to say something while the puck is in play, it better be really quick because it can wind up in the net in a heartbeat. And it often does.
Yeah. Tell stories that end at the end of every sentence. That's one of the coolest concepts that I've been introduced to. I'm going to be...
Tell it to other people and you'd be amazed, you know, I do it all the time now, you know, and especially, you know, you prioritize, you know, okay, what's the most important part of the story? Does it need all the rest of it? And sometimes you're doing a football game, it's 52-6. You can tell it over several plays if you have to. I mean, if someone scores a long touchdown, then you interrupt it for a minute, you show the replay, and then you get back and tell the story. But sometimes it's you just have, you know, time to say something unfortunate, like, you know, his mom got hit by a car last week and she's in the hospital, you know, whatever. So and I hate to keep dwelling on negative stories. His mom won the lottery and, you know, but you really do have to prioritize sometimes just in real time. Okay, I want to get this story in. I don't have time for all of it. So what are the two or three sentences that are most central to this being interesting and timely?
When you talk about applying that to the different sports that you just mentioned, baseball, hockey, golf, football, how has calling so many different sports helped you hone your craft throughout the course of your career?
Yeah, in different ways, right? Especially like the storytelling part really came from baseball. And that started my first broadcasting job, you know, really outside of college, was broadcasting minor league baseball in Syracuse, New York. We have the AAA team for the Toronto Blue Jays, Syracuse Chiefs. And, you know, a lot of times on the road, you're the only broadcaster. So there's no one to banter with, you know, so you learn how to tell stories and describe things. And a lot of times you lean heavily on the out-of-town scoreboard as filler material. If there's nothing going on, you repeat the scores, or, you know, there's always little things you can do to fill the time. But you learn how to be a storyteller when you're broadcasting minor league baseball or something like that by yourself. So, you know, it's things like that. And then the other sports you kind of learn, you know, hockey. When we first got back in, I was too slow. I'd watch the games and like catch up to the play. You know, it's rat-a-tat-tat. And some people's manner of speaking or whatever is just a certain way. But in hockey, you better speed it up. So you don't want to constantly be behind the play. And I, you know, and as I said, at that first year, especially, I got stuck way too many times even a little anecdote, like, you know, he got a degree from Harvard in gold. You know, you're like, oh, geez. You know, it's like, so you never want to be in the middle of a sentence when a big play is happening in any sport. But, you know, they all have their rhythm and flow. But to me, it's the same job responsibility, right? Most of all, describing what's happening, keeping on top of the game situations, the strategy, and anything related to that that's pertinent, interacting with your analyst and the sideline reporter in the truck, and then hopefully adding in all these other, you know, things, biographical stories, whatever the case may be, big picture things, you know, how is their team doing relative to other teams in their league or nationally? They're number one in the country. Should they be? You know, there's always stuff to talk about, but it's just kind of a managing, as we talked about before, what's the right thing at the right time. But it's the same skill, whether it's football, baseball, basketball, hockey. I've done, I think it's 11 sports on national TV. And people say, wow, that's amazing. I say, well, it's the same thing. You know, you just need to know the rules, right? And you'd be prepared. You know, if you go do the bobsled and you have no idea about how, you know, what makes a good bobsledder, then you probably shouldn't do it. But that's an example, because that sport's really not that complex. I mean, you all jump on the sled and try to go as fast as you can. You know, there are intricacies to it. But so anyway, you know, it's the same skill. And if you keep up with what's going on, I think it is adaptable.
I would imagine if it's almost like a hub and spoke mentality, these are the things that I always need to do. And then depending on the 11 different hub spokes for the 11 different sports, this is how it needs to be adjusted. As part of that preparation, do you have, I mean, I know you've been doing this for so long now, some of us probably just wrote, you go through your routine and you adjust. But if you're going to do a baseball game, a football game, a hockey game, a tennis match, golf, you know, whatever it might be at this point, do you try to put yourself in a certain frame of mind or put yourself at a certain pace or certain cadence or certain approach before those sports? Or do you just go in and adapt to the moment and what's happening in front of you?
Yeah, I think you go in and adapt. You know, a lot of times the first game of the year, like we have our first hockey game of the season coming up here in a couple of weeks. And, you know, sometimes it just takes you a minute. And it's not just the speed of it, pacing of it, whatever, but it's the lingo, you know, that there's a certain way that you typically describe how they dump it in the corner, cross ice pass. You know, some people say rink wide, or whatever. It's sometimes it takes a little bit just for the rhythm of that to come back. How, you know, the verbiage that you use to describe things. But I find that typically it comes back pretty fast. You know, within the first period of a hockey game, the first quarter of a football game. And then golf is a totally different thing. You know, it's there's kind of a lot of little rules. Like in golf, you don't want to be talking over the shot. You know, when somebody, it's okay in the setup of the shot, it's a 140 yards, it's a pitching wedge, it's above the winds from the right. But then don't be talking when, just like you wouldn't be talking in the middle of the shot if you were standing there playing golf with him or her. So they all have their own kind of little rules, but you know, it doesn't take much time, I think, to kind of get back into the speed and flow of each of them. But most of them are, they're all kind of different in their own way.
Yeah. I think even just that little line about the lingo is really important from a credibility standpoint. You have casual fans that watch sports and wouldn't pick it up, but you're diehard fans. And I would imagine in hockey, far more so than baseball or football, the certain words, the certain phrases, the certain descriptions, somebody who watches a sport all the time, who maybe has played it, coached it, they're into it, they're going to know that's what you call that 100%. Move, that technique, that play.
100%.
And the credibility.
And when I got the hockey, for example, a lot of people didn't remember we had the hockey 17 years before and that I was a part of it. But a lot of the other people who are still at ESPN, John Bucci Gross and Steve Levy, you know, and Linda Cohn, to name a few. But immediately, like when I got hired, before I even done the game, why they hire him? He's not a hockey guy, you know? So did you think, well, to your point, well, now I really need to prove I'm a hockey guy. And I remember one of the first games we did, I said he threw the ball off the glass or something. I immediately caught myself and said puck, but it was just fodder for, he doesn't even know it's a puck, which, you know, I know it's a puck. Sometimes we misspeak, even if we do sort of know what we're talking about. So, but you're right. You know, and that's one of the things, like when I got assigned to do the bobsled and luge in the Olympics, when I was at CBS back in the 90s, I was very fortunate that I got to go up to Lake Placid and spend time around the athletes and the coaches and the PR people for the different U.S. Luge and bobsled associations, and basically had them explain it to me. You know, what makes a good luger? What makes a good bobsledder? I had a chance to do a luge and a bobsled run. And, you know, it really gives you an appreciation of, A, how fast it goes, kind of in a frightening sort of way. But, you know, you need the verbiage is really important. And the most important thing is getting the names right. Because if I'm going to do Kentucky football, if I'm a Kentucky football fan and you mispronounce the name of one of our players and I know you really botched it, then that's a big problem. And so if you're going to get anything right, or if you're going to at least prioritize getting things right, the most important thing is pronounce the names right. And sometimes it's hard, you know, like in hockey, you got a lot of players from foreign countries. You know, I did Olympic hockey when I was at CBS, and you have China playing Russia in women's hockey. You know, like, oh, my goodness. So hey,
what did I do to get this assignment?
Get the names right. And sometimes you know, I'll go right to the player, him or herself, and say, hey, I've heard your name pronounced this way, that way. The coach calls you this. The sports information director calls you that. Like here in Boston, you know, Brad Marchand, you know, star player for the Bruins, the radio team called him one thing, and the TV, Bruins TV team called him another thing. And then I asked him, I said, I've heard you called this and that. And he said, I really don't care. So he finally said, well, how does your mother pronounce it? You know, but that's the most important thing. It's the most basic thing. But if you blow that, then your credibility is gone, especially with the people who know that team for sure.
Yeah, I think people underestimate how sometimes the littlest details have the biggest impact on credibility.
Right. And most of the time, like if it's, there seems to be some, you know, ideally, if you have access to the player, you ask them or her. If not, I try to go with whatever the radio, the local announcer, you know, if you do a Clemson football game, what's the voice of the Tigers, Don Munson, call this guy? Because that's what their fans are used to hearing. And he probably, and he's such a pro anyway, it's a good example because he would make sure he knew how to pronounce the names. But, you know, most of the time, if you're not sure, go with the people who at least should know the best.
Yeah. I'm keeping an eye on the clock because I know you've got a visiting football interview coming up very soon, and I want to be respectful of your schedule. So I'd like to ask you one more minute. Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you. You've called some very, very big moments in sports. You mentioned the Michigan State punt, which my buddy Justin was more happy with than most people on the planet, is a huge Michigan State fan when that happened. Some of them are spontaneous. But some of them, you know, you're going into game 7 of a World Series. You know, you're going into a football game that has national title implications, or, you know, you call them playoff hockey. Maybe it's a series deciding game. If they win tonight,
right.
The series
game 7, over. Usually we had a game 7 of the Stanley Cup final. And to your point, you know, I'm on a text chain with, I went to Syracuse. We have a number of prominent sports broadcasters who were there. Around the same time, or not even those who were around the same time as I was, but we're friends, and there's probably 20 of us on there, guys like Mike Tirico and Dave Pash and Ian Eagle and a lot of great broadcasters. And before game 7, I actually kind of put it out there almost as a survey, you know, would you kind of script what you're going to say, or at least think about what you want to say? And the only time I ever really did it was when the first year I did the World Series in 92, for CBS. I did it in 92 and 93 with Tim McCarver. The Toronto Blue Jays were playing the Atlanta Braves.
Yes.
The Blue Jays won. And I had pretty much thought I was going to say something like, for the first time ever, you know, the baseball's world championship banner will fly north of the border. And it sounded scripted to me. Now, a lot of people in Toronto say, oh, that's great. I associate that forever with the... but to me, when I listened back to it, that sounded scripted. And, you know, there's some people, broadcasters do that and it works well for them. But, you know, we had an epic game 7, the last Stanley Cup final we had this past June, Edmonton and Florida. Looked like it was going to be, might be a 4-game sweep. We wound up having a game 7. And even though I surveyed them, it was such an exciting ending. You know, the final seconds were counting down. It was a 2-1 game. And when the buzzer sounded, I just said, the Florida Panthers have won the Stanley Cup. I actually screamed it. And then stop. That's the right. Anything else to me would have just sound contrived, you know, like no one is that articulate in the moment to come up with some really flowing thing that just comes out of your mind. So, and I listened back to it, I'm like, you know, that was the right punctuation moment for that. And then the next thing is just shut up, because there's nothing you can say. Like that Michigan State game, you know, that they won the last play of the game, whatever. I said, unbelievable. I think I said with my voice squeaking. And then I don't know how long Chris and I went without talking, but it was a long time, because there's nothing you can say that's better than the pictures. The same thing. The Florida Panthers have won the Stanley Cup, and it's the coach who's the lifer. You know, we've already told that story. Paul Maurice, after 28 years, whatever it was, in the NHL, his assistant coach is hugging him, his players hugging him, you know, the crowd. And there's nothing you can say that's better. We probably went way more than a minute without saying anything. So sometimes I think we broadcasters want to be too much a part of the moment, when we should just kind of say, all right, here's what happened, punctuate it, and get out of the way.
And I would imagine, especially, that's an emotional moment, no matter who you were rooting for. If you're the team that just won, you're flying off your couch. If you're the team that just lost, your head is in your hands. And you're
We had shots of Connor McDavid, you know, greatest player in the world, clearly distraught. You know, he had played a huge part both on and off the ice of leading them back into the series. And, you know, our producer and director and camera people did such a great job of capturing all the right shots at the right time. You know, there's nothing. Oh, there's Connor McDavid, and he's really distraught. You know, no crap. You know, it's like, that's another thing that you should never, you know, I tell broadcasters all the time, you should never say something over a TV shot that's a no crap, to clean it up a little bit, Sherlock statement. Yeah. You know, it shouldn't say stuff that clearly does not need to be said. Oh, he's really happy. Really? Wouldn't have known that myself watching it. So, yeah.
Even that line right there, I'm actually writing it down as I'm saying it, talking about being terrible at multitasking. Don't say what doesn't need to be said. That was a rule that we all live by.
I'm sure a lot of people watch this podcast, right? Or people are speaking in front of groups, and, you know, the old, what's the 5 B's? Be brief, brother, be brief, you know, when you're speaking. So obviously I failed that miserably today, but I think if in doubt, don't say anything is a pretty good way to go through life.
I couldn't agree.
Save you a lot of problems in your personal relationships too.
Yes. I tell you what, I think that is such an accurate and profound statement. Let's wrap it up on that. When in doubt, don't say anything. Let the moment say itself.
No, that's really, you know, when I'm on the air, and especially if it's a big moment, I do it all the time now, you know, because there's just nothing you can say that's going to be better than what the people are seeing and hearing.
And I imagine that, especially in that role, it takes a certain level of confidence to be able to do that. Because I'm sure a lot of play-by-play announcers and analysts feel like it's their responsibility to narrate everything that's happening. So in order to have the confidence to say, I'm going to sit back and let this story tell itself, that's a different level.
Yeah, I was doing a big game, and the analyst tended to jump in a lot, and it was clearly coming down the wire. And the producer said in the analyst's ear, hey, if you scream and yell after this game ends and it's a captivating ending, I'm just going to have the audio person kill your mic. So don't do it. You know, let the people enjoy the moment. You don't have to attach yourself to the moment. Some of these people, you know, I hate to say this about some couple, but they kind of do it knowingly, because they know this is a big moment. And if I just keep talking, I'm going to be attached to this big moment forever. And that's not our place. Again, it's enhanced people's enjoyment of the game, not detract from it.
Yes. Well, I can't thank you enough for all of the time, all of the examples, all of the great insights that you shared today. I really appreciate it. I think it's very easy to say, no matter what anybody does for a living, after listening to this conversation, they're going to have different perspectives, approaches, and ideas for how to approach those conversations based on listening to you. So thank you so very much for taking the time and sharing so much with us today.
My pleasure. I wish we had more time. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
My pleasure as well. Maybe if there's more than enough meat on the bone from where I'm sitting, so maybe some other time.
We'll do part two down the road.
That would be my pleasure. I appreciate it. Travel safe. Enjoy the games. Keep up the great work. Thank you so much for being here.
Appreciate it. Thanks for your kindness. Thank you.
Take care. John, thank you for a tremendous conversation. I not only appreciate you carving out the time for us today, but thank you for sharing wall-to-wall insight and examples that we can all apply to our conversations outside of the sports booth, in our offices, with our customers, and at home. Thank you so very much. Tough to recap just a few things without going back over the conversation entirely, but I really love the point you made about when we do a better job illustrating why we're asking a question and what we're trying to achieve with the question, we have a much easier time obtaining the answers and information that we're looking for. The example you gave with Jimmy Williams was perfect. As soon as you were able to say, I want to make sure I'm not unfairly criticizing you, it was easier for him to open up and share what you were looking for. That was a great example. That line you used about telling a story that can end with every sentence is very powerful. That's something that I personally am going to start working on, as I've been rightfully accused of being somebody who can ramble on a little bit too much from time to time. So I really appreciate you sharing that. That's something that I personally will be working on for sure. The thought of don't say what doesn't need to be said, and if you're not sure what to say, don't say anything, are rules we should all be living by in all of our conversations. Very powerful. Don't say what doesn't need to be said. If you're not sure what to say, let it pass. Don't say anything. Which gets back to, in a lot of ways, I believe, the mantra that you shared, which is enhance moments, don't detract from moments. Let people enjoy the moment. For many of us, in many of the contexts and situations we find ourselves in, the moment is for the person to experience. It's not about us. It's about them. And I love how you illustrated that. Thank you for so much for all that you shared during the conversation today. And thank you to everybody that took the time to join us. Really appreciate y'all. Hopefully you took as many notes as I did, and we'll be applying these to your conversations every day as well. So before we go, let's thank our sponsors, HumanTel. Head over to humantel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training. Check out their research, read their articles, choose the training that's right for you, and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the training of your choice, and you will be on the way to developing the techniques necessary, the ability necessary to identify what people are likely thinking and feeling at any time by recognizing shifts in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. I've done it all. I recommend it. And Quasive25 is your code at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. Again, that's where you get all your questions answered about the International Association of Interviewers. Who should apply? What are the benefits for members, teams, and individuals? Education opportunities online and in person, resources, networking, additional opportunities, so much more. That's also where you'll learn everything you need to know about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Who qualifies? How do you become approved to take the exam? What's entailed in the exam? How do you study? Once you earn the designation, what could it mean for you and your career moving forward? What types of opportunities does the designation unlock? All that and more over at certifiedinterviewer.com. And finally, while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you will learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leadership, business development, and HR teams, to teach them the strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques necessary to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. In turn, forging stronger relationships and arriving at long-lasting agreements. All of that and more at inquasive.com. Thank you all very much for being here week after week. We truly appreciate you coming back. Please, before you go, like the show, share the show, leave us your feedback, subscribe on your favorite platform so you know when this new episodes drop every week. We really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much. Leave us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. Stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.